Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, I want to take on a slightly controversial issue, touching our food. Now, there is this odd reaction we weird out about touching the very thing that we absorb into our bodies, as in cooking with our hands. You know, if you think about it, your hands are the cheapest tool you've got, and your immaculately clean hands can tell you things no gadget ever could. And cooking with your hands could make you a cook of the first order. Well, this hour, we talk cooking with your hands the way the pros do it, with San Francisco chef Daniel Patterson. That and a lot more coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today we are taking on the ick factor in cooking, as in touching our food with our hands. Now, we're going to learn why touch rules in the professional kitchen from a pro's pro, chef and writer Daniel Patterson. So let's say you're going to buy a new grill. Well, what's worth the money and what's not? We're going to get the answers from a grill goddess who has tried them all. Now, the man who wrote 1,000 recordings to hear before you die, and he has listened to every single one, talks what to play for eating outside. Music for a summer night. And as always, we're going to be talking to you, but first let's get to Jane and Michael Stern. They're the minds behind roadfood.com. So Jane, Michael, you know, sliders are showing up in fancy restaurants. What's the state of the slider these days, and how do you define one?
Sliders used to be the most ignominious branch of hamburger cookery. You know what a slider is a teeny-weeny, ultra-thin hamburger on a teeny-weeny patty, preferably with some chopped onions and a pickle chip. You know, they were invented in the middle of the country back in the 1920s at a place called the Cozy Inn, and also White Castle started around then in the place.
Yeah.
And White Castle is sort of what everybody knows as the traditional source of sliders. But sliders are no longer so déclassé. Jane and I have come across Kobe beef sliders.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly the thing. What's happening?
I don't know what's happening. We've even come across sliders that aren't even hamburgers, which to me, a slider always meant hamburger. But we've come across something on upscale menus called tuna tartare sliders.
And crab cake sliders.
Crab cake sliders. It's kind of silly. I mean, Jane and I, being traditionalists, really go for the—
Why are they called sliders?
I think because they slide across the grill so easily, the grill being so greasy.
Oh, no.
I never understood.
Because you buy them in a sack and they steam. And they're so wonderfully greasy to begin with, and then the bun starts to actually, the little bun disintegrates, and when you put it in your mouth, the whole thing just goes right down.
Slides down your throat.
That's what I always thought, anyway.
Okay. Anyway, the fact is, I mean, you can get these fancy upscale sliders, you know, they're butlered hors d'oeuvres at some parties we've been to, but, you know, we like the classics. For example, Hunter House Hamburgers in Birmingham, Michigan. Now, this is one of those kind of roadside places. It looks like it's out of an Edward Hopper painting. And there, you know, like 6 or 8 sliders make a nice meal. And they're almost see-through thin, but they imprint the bun with enough of that hamburger flavor that it's just sort of a perfect 1 or maybe 2 mouthful burger.
I really like Crabbles in Urbana, Ohio.
Oh, that's a great one. That is a great one. In fact, I say Craybills, Jane says Crabbles, whatever it may be. They've got an ongoing slider eating contest. The last time we were there, the record had been set only fairly recently by a guy named Hank Carpenter, who ate 33 in a single sitting.
They're also
that's really overkill beyond.
Yeah, I would say six or eight is fine with me.
Aren't they made in like deep oil?
Well, they're made on a grill, but the grill is tilted so that at the deeper end of the grill, the burgers are almost deep frying.
This is really, when you think about it, I mean, this is great Americana, right?
Well, it is. And as I said, they go back to the 1920s. And, you know, the thing about most places that serve the traditional sliders is that they're the sort of place that you really want to find when you're taking a road trip. I mean, those places that are open late at night where basically all seating is at a counter where if you sit there for more than 10 or 15 minutes, you walk out smelling like onions and hamburgers for the rest of the day.
Mm, right. My favorite perfume.
Oh, yeah. You know, I take the burger and just dot it a little bit behind each ear before biting. But have you got any other places?
Yeah, I've got a beaut. It's Crazy Jim's Blimpy Burger in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
The name alone is worth the trip. What's the place like?
The thing to get at Crazy Jim's is not a single, but a quint, which is five of these in one bun.
What, are they stacked or are they laid out
side by side? They're stacked and layered with a combination of over 6 million different toppings.
Okay, great dissertation on the slider. Thank you, guys.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late, perhaps my all-time favorite title. Now, you know the Sterns are here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you feel like it. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, at our house, we've been doing Cannot Shop Weeks, where we eat only what's in the house, which has revealed an embarrassing number of unfortunate choices on my part, like jarred marinades that anybody could make for a quarter of the price. Now, the one difference in a homemade marinade is that it's not going to keep for a long time. I mean, you can hold them usually for about a week in the fridge. But the other side of it is they take minutes to make. And one of the money-saving tricks is buy ingredients only as you need them. So, for instance, to make your own Italian balsamic marinade, you combine garlic, balsamic vinegar, olive oil, black pepper, and dry or fresh basil. And a handy balsamic trick to know is that you can make the cheap balsamic taste more like the pricey stuff by boiling it down for 10 minutes with a little sugar. Figure 1 or 2 tablespoons of sugar per cup of vinegar. Now, for a simplified and properly hot jerk marinade, puree together a Scotch bonnet or an habanero chili. And by the way, wear gloves when you handle these babies. They are hot as Hades. Anyway, you puree them with oil, vinegar, onion, and then thyme, allspice, black pepper, and cinnamon. Now, for a basic Asian marinade, puree together equal parts of fresh ginger and garlic with soy sauce, sugar, and pepper to taste. Now, what I'm really after here is trusting our tastes instead of following a recipe by rote. So I'm going to post these ideas on the web just as you heard them here. The trick is taste as you go, and I promise you, all will be delicious. Instincts is a great way to cook, but when it comes to what I cook on, like a grill, I like to lean on somebody that's been there and done that a lot. Elizabeth Carmel is dubbed the barbecue queen. She's been welcomed into the Southern Society of the Good Old Boys of the Barbecue, and she's made it her business to test out just about all of the grills on the market. She's author of Taming the Flame. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, what's the newest stuff right now in grilling?
Well, you know what? Everything that's old is new again, in a way. In the last decade or so, Americans have really embraced gas grilling because of the convenience factor. That's what I think. It's, you know, it's as easy as flipping a switch, and it's preheated in 15 minutes, and you don't have to add charcoal. But now, with sort of the explosion of interest in barbecue and smoking, people are going back to charcoal. And the really neat thing, I think, is that they're just buying a second grill so that they use a gas grill when they're time pressed and they, you know, they need to get dinner on the table really quickly. And then they use the charcoal grill when they have a little bit more leisure time and they want to do some low and slow cooking. And I really think that's the best way to maximize your outdoor cooking experience.
So what's your take on those combo grills that they're selling where you get the gas and the charcoal, but it's essentially in one unit?
Well, I have to tell you, my recommendation is to buy a gas grill and to buy a charcoal grill, because my feeling is that if it's combined into one cart, the ones that I've seen don't do either very well. They don't cook very well with gas, and they don't cook very well with charcoal.
Elizabeth, what about this infrared grilling?
Well, you know, this is new technology, and it's a little bit confusing. But basically, this is what infrared technology does in a gas grill. The technology deflects the flame to create an even radiant heat by using a shiny plate that's placed over the gas burner. So what that means is there's no direct flame at all.
I see.
The fats and the juices drip down into this plate that is actually over the gas burner. So there's no direct flame, and it's cooking all by radiant heat. So the idea is that it actually will extinguish the problem of flare-ups so that people can get a really great sear on their food, or they can actually bring the temperature down and cook low and slow on these infrared grills.
So if you're going to spring for, you know, kind of the ultimate grill, what would you do?
Okay, well, first, let me tell you the three top things that people should look for when they're buying a gas grill. Number one, they should look for consistent and even heat.
Right.
Number two, they should make sure that the grill can be configured for direct and indirect heat. That means that you can, you know, sear over direct heat and then finish cooking over indirect heat, or you can do barbecue on a gas grill.
Right.
And that means that you need at least three burners so that you can keep two on and turn one off. And then finally, you want to make sure that it is sturdy. Don't be afraid to kick the tires a little bit and shake the grill and make sure that it's a really sturdy piece of equipment. Because if you buy a good grill, it can last you decades, really.
So let's talk brands. Are there some brands that you favor over others?
Well, I always tell people to buy the best possible grill they can possibly afford. And, you know, if you want me to get specific about brands, which I know you do, in my experience, Weber has the most consistent heat of any of the grills out there, regardless of the price point.
Well, this is great. Elizabeth, thank you.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Elizabeth Carmel's latest book is Soaked, Slathered, and Seasoned, a complete guide to flavoring food for the grill. You can find Elizabeth's recipe for chipotle chicken thighs on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're hanging out on the site, check out our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. We make worknight eating easier with a new recipe each week, along with tips, deathless pros, and assorted discoveries. Then there's our podcast and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. All treasures are waiting for you at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Touching in the Kitchen and Music to Eat By on a Summer Night. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Just Bare Chicken, all natural with no antibiotics, vegetable fed,
cage-free, traceable to the family farm we're raised. Just Bear Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbearchicken.com. You know, one of the constant questions we get is, what are the essential tools for a cook? Well, we can speculate on and on, but when in doubt, go to the pros. Chefs don't have time to fool around with gadgets that don't work. And for the talented ones, perfection is essential. Well, we've got an award-winning chef, Daniel Patterson, with us. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So for you, what tops the list of your favorite tools?
My hands.
Why am I not surprised?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. It's you can go out and you can buy any kind of high-tech tools, but at the end of the day, there's one thing that gives more information more accurately and more consistently than anything else, and that's my hands.
You know, I've always thought that too, but when you watch these chef shows, all of these people are using tongs. So what's with the tongs?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, when I started working in restaurants 25 years ago, I thought tongs were fantastic because I'd never seen them before at home.
Uh-huh.
And went in, and everyone was using tongs. And the great thing about the tongs is that you could twirl them around on your finger and look really cool.
It's sort of the gunslinger's approach to cooking.
Exactly. I was 14 years old. You know, that looked pretty good to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, what I realized over time is that it's kind of tongs are they're really a brutal way of handling food. They're not sensitive to the food.
Yeah.
They're kind of rough around the edges, and they tend to tear things. And you don't learn anything. So if we have a very hot piece of meat in a pan,
mm-hmm.
We use a spoon to turn it, or we use chopsticks, which have metal ends, which we got in Japan, and basically everyone around the kitchen has them. And then that's what we use to turn things. So, and honestly, we'll put our hands into hot pans as much as anything else.
Yeah, but you guys, I mean, you have the skins of an orange.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's not a recommendation.
but how do you use touch? I mean, for we home cooks, how do you recommend we use our hands to tell us that information you refer to?
Well, a great example is I was just talking about this with a friend of mine. They used to have all kinds of problems figuring out when a piece of meat was done. And my wife used to be the same way. She would take it out of the pan, cut it with a knife, and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't done, it would go back into the pan, leaking juices. And then sometimes if this piece of meat was really unlucky, it would come out, it would get cut again,
and then
go back in again. At which point, you know, by the time I got it, it was kind of mangled and... You know, I would just kind of sit there quietly. And eventually I showed her. I said, look, just if you feel it and you get used to what feels like rare, what feels like medium rare, then you don't have to go through that whole process. And so she, over time, learned how to touch the meat to figure out when it was done and what it felt like. And that and there's some shorthand to that in touching the space between your thumb and your first finger.
Right.
Feels kind of like rare, and you know, the tip of your nose is I forget what it is, medium well or something. I never learned this. A friend of mine told me, and I put it in a story I wrote one time, and then of course promptly forgot it the next minute.
Yeah, but I have to tell you, I remember it because I read that story. The tip of your nose, you said, was medium. Your earlobe was rare. Notice how this stuck. Can you believe this? Your earlobe was rare. Medium was your nose, and your chin was well done. But
yeah, that sounds right.
Does that apply to everything? I mean, like to a chicken breast, to a piece of fish?
No, it's more kind of red meat steak.
Yeah. The other thing I'm thinking about is how often do you use your hands to know what size a portion is or to measure?
Hmm. Not very often. For that, I use my eyes. We use scales, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, the information that's so important in terms of touch is like tossing a salad. So using tongs to toss a salad, what happens is the metal bruises the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And there is nothing that is better suited to toss a salad than your hands, which are going to be soft. They're going to be gentle in how they do it. And they're going to mix the leaves completely. And you're going to be able to feel when they're coated just right. And, you know, the tongs, they're never going to tell you when the leaves are coated. And then, you know, the other thing is for seasoning. So a lot of times people will use spoons and kind of sprinkle things. So we use our hands because the way that the salt falls out of our hands is much more even and much more controllable.
Yeah, and the other thing is that this gives you a connection to your food.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think the thing about the tongs, too, is it's, you know, you're outside in the backyard and you're grilling and they're perfectly fine. But they're, in a way, kind of symptomatic to me of a larger remove from our food that's happened over the last 40 or 50 years. And people have gotten afraid to engage with what they're eating.
Mm.
And there's something about the tactile interaction between between your food and touching it that leads to kind of a deeper sensitivity and in a way kind of brings you closer to what you're cooking.
You know, I think you're right. It's a deeper engagement.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Daniel, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Daniel Patterson is chef owner of Koi in San Francisco, and he's co-author of the book Aroma. Now, to warm up to tearing up greens and tossing with your hands, try my recipe for summer salad of greens and peaches. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. In the kitchen, well, that's sensual. Eating outside on a warm night, that's sensual and could be romantic. I mean, Shakespeare nailed it. He said, if music be the food of love, play on. Well, I don't care if it's takeout on the fire escape. When you have got the right music, anything is possible. Well, the man to make that right music happen is the guy who listens to everything, and he cooks too. Music critic Tom Moon is author of 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. Hey, Tom, it's good to have you back.
Great to be with you.
So I was sitting out on the patio the other night, and I thought of you because I had the radio on, and the music was, you know, kind of happening. And I was just thinking, when you think about music to eat by, do you have kind of a different way of looking at it when you're eating outside than when you're eating inside?
I think a little bit, because you're aware that it's going to get sort of eaten up by the environment and you're not going to have anyone's undivided attention. What you're doing is you're sort of setting a mood. And if you think of it like that and you sort of think about the way DJs think about setting a mood in a nightclub, say, there's a real psychology to starting out. And the DJ trick is to, even if there's no one on the dance floor, to sort of get into the psychology of sending you subliminal messages that this is going to be a good place to hang out for a while. And that's what you want to do at home. That's what I try to do. So like my first hour, I'll think a lot about what I'm going to have in the mix in the first hour that just sort of subliminally says, hey, this is going to be fun. We're going to have a good time. We're all going to relax.
So how would you do that?
Well, first, with a lot of upbeat music, with music that's somewhat familiar, things that sort of, even if you don't know the song, like if you hear something reggae, you just know, you know, okay, we're in the islands, we're going to chill.
Yeah, yeah.
And likewise, with a lot of those old R&B hits, there's something about hearing somebody like Jackie Wilson sing. he was this great R&B singer, and he just had this way about him. He influenced Elvis Presley. He sort of has this very buoyant vibe. And the other night when I had folks over, I played Reed Petit, which was a hit for him in 1957. And it's just, you know, it's a big band, shouty kind of thing. And it seemed to just lift up the whole room.
Well, look about, look about, look about, look about. Ooh, wee. Look about, look about, look about. Ooh, wee. Ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, wee. Well, she's so fine, fine. She's really sweet, the finest girl that ever wanted me.
Oh, I see what you mean. I mean, that says we are going to have a very, very good time tonight.
Yeah, it's just lightheartedness, you know. And the thing is that what you realize is when people show up at your door, they may not be in the mode you want them to be in right away. And so that DJ trick of like sort of very subtly sending the signal, hey, we're going to chill, it's all going to be good. If you can figure out a few things that do that, you're going to have a great night.
So what's next? Where would you go from there?
Oh, boy. Well, often I find it's really hard to have music that has vocals on it when you're actually eating. So once people are sitting down or they're milling about the table, they're getting their food, I want to sort of put it into a different spot. And often I'll have some jazz or some classical music, something that's just very almost spare, that's like that becomes part of the breeze that you're feeling outside. You're not even aware of it as music, sort of. But if you do choose to listen, it's beautiful. Give a listen to this. This is piano music by a composer named Leos Janacek, who created this wonderful piece. It's like a suite of small solo piano works called On an Overgrown Path. And it's just wonderful little reveries. And you can totally hear this going on in the background.
You know, the thing about this that you hit upon, eating outside, there's that completely different sensation. You have the aromas of, you know, the grass or the plants or whatever. But the point being, the sensuality of this, there's a sense of reverie about it that it just, I think it all comes together. It's a really great pick.
It's, well, thank you. It's music I really love, and it does seem to work in that way of, like, with, again, subliminally connecting us to nature. Like, he was thinking about nature when he wrote this, and it kind of puts you in that frame even without listening carefully.
Well, okay, along those lines, how about one more thing? It's the end of the evening, and I'm thinking, you know, soft summer night, a little seduction.
There's so much great, I know, right? There's so much great music that has that vibe in it. And, you know, when you think about the stars are out, it's going to be, you're going to be partying, you're going to be hugging people. You know, you hear someone, like a voice like Sam Cooke, and you just want to sort of have an embrace. And he's one of those people who works for all generations. You hear his voice and you simply melt. Here's a cut I just love. It's one of his first hits. It was from 1957. It's called You Send Me.
Okay. I'm kicking off my shoes. We're dancing on the lawn.
Exactly. You almost can't help but dance when you hear that. It's just slow. It's perfect. You know, it's mellow. You've done this thing. You've had this evening, and it's a great way to sort of send it off.
I love it. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
I know when you're home. Music critic Tom Moon is the author of 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. Now, Tom's dining al fresco playlist is on the website, along with my recipe for iced summer peaches, just the thing to go with Sam Cooke. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Are open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, we have got Minnow calling from Los Angeles. Hey, Minnow, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about garlic.
That's not hard.
I love it, and I want to enjoy it more, but I have got, the darndest thing happens to me whenever I try and saute with garlic, which is that it burns in like a millisecond. I've tried it on lower heat. I've tried it with different kinds of oils. I don't know if it's the way that I'm chopping it. I don't know if it's that I'm using old garlic. It just burns in like seconds on me.
Well, you know, okay, walk me through how you would do that saute.
Okay. Well, I just learned from a friend that sometimes it's good to heat the pan before you heat the oil.
Right.
So yeah. I've started doing that, but I will chop up my garlic. Sometimes I'll slice it thinly.
Right.
I used to use a press, but then I read in some book that that kind of breaks everything down sometimes.
Well, you know, you can if you want to. I just find it really, I chop it, but it's a matter of taste.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So I chop it, and I'll get the oil heated up a little bit, but not smoking or anything crazy. And I'll throw the garlic in, you know, swirl it around for a little bit, and then throw in, you know, my veggies or fish or whatever it is that I'm sautéing. But it seems like by the time the other stuff is cooked, the garlic is totally crispy.
Yeah. That's what I thought you were doing. No. It's you know, a lot of recipes say chop the onion and the celery and the carrots and the garlic and cook, you know, and then sauté them.
Right.
And the garlic is much tinier. The garlic has a lot of natural juice in it. And what happens is, for whatever reason, the garlic burns by the time the other things are browned. Reverse what you're doing, okay?
Okay.
What you do is get your pan, you know, hot, get the oil hot, sauté those base vegetables of whatever you're doing.
Okay.
Once they're just about where you want them, okay, add the minced garlic or the chopped garlic or the sliced garlic.
Okay, great.
That will do it. And if you're doing, let's say, a piece of fish that you just want garlic with it and you want to flavor the oil with garlic.
Right, that's what I'm always kind of trying to do.
Okay, then what you do is put your oil in the pan. Do exactly what you're doing, but have in your hand a slotted spoon.
Ooh, okay.
And just when the garlic starts to go a little blonde, sweep it out.
Okay.
Keep it on a plate. Do whatever you're going to do in that oil, saute the fish or whatever. And then when you serve it, put the garlic on top of it or mix
Fantastic.
It into the sauce. You see, so you get, and you what you get there is some really gorgeous garlic. You know, you don't let it brown. You just let it barely get blonde.
Right.
Another trick, okay, if you want to have your garlic really mellowed, all you have to do is put it in that oil. Warm the oil up in the pan, add a little water to the pan and cover the pan, and your garlic will cook. I do this in big chunks. And when the garlic is soft, mm-hmm. lift the lid. Okay, it's going to be snapping and popping a bit.
Okay.
Use your slotted spoon, get rid of the garlic, and then you can stand back while you cook off the liquid and then cook in that oil. And then you've got these chunks of really soft, sweet garlic that you can sprinkle over the top of whatever
Ooh,
you're
that
making.
That sounds really good.
You do
so
that.
Cover it for a while. Kind of like steam them for a while, right?
The idea is the water keeps them from burning.
Okay,
and you're sort of poaching them.
I do that sometimes when I'm doing greens, you know, at the very end when they're starting to kind of, it's starting to brown on the bottom of the pan, I'll just add a little water and steam it for the last
same
minute.
Idea. It's just a protector. But the idea is the garlic goes in generally after you've browned the vegetables, not before.
Okay. Why don't recipes tell you that?
I don't know. You know, what can I tell you? When we rule the world, Minnow, it's all going to be different.
Oh, good. I look forward to that. Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. You take care.
You too.
Bye. Okay, it is time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, where in the United States is the world's most expensive seasoning grown? Now, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, where in the United States is the world's most expensive seasoning grown? Well, the world's most expensive seasoning is saffron at a mere $2,000 a pound. Now, I say saffron, and you think only in Spain, unless you are on the listserv of the Association for the Study of Food and Society. Then you would know that there has been a secret cache of local saffron here in the United States since the 1730s. Now, this is probably information only a history geek could love, but saffron was then and is now grown in the kitchen gardens of Mennonites in the Pennsylvania Dutch country. They use saffron in everything from soup to dessert. Now, it's sold off the commercial grid, often family to family. But if you're in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, that's southeastern Pennsylvania, ask around. And by the way, eat there. The pie alone is worth a trip. Now, if you want to know more about local food in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, check out food historian William Moyes Weaver. All right, back to the phones and your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have got Jonathan on the phone calling from Long Beach. Hey, Jonathan, what do you want to talk about?
Tilapia.
The fish, yes.
Yes. Yeah, I had recently bought tilapia for sale at a local market, and now I don't really know what to do with it. And it's just kind of like, all I know is that you can put, like, lemon with, like, other types of fish, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions on what I could do, because I'm just stuck with a bag of tilapia in the freezer.
You are not stuck. This is an opportunity. What you've got there, though, is a blank canvas, because tilapia is a very mild-tasting fish. The fillets are fairly thin, so it's going to cook pretty quick. Have you cooked much fish?
Basically just salmon.
Well, that's a good start. The trick with fish is to make sure you don't overcook it. And, for instance, with the tilapia, I think the easiest way is going to be to do it in a nonstick skillet. Mm-hmm. You know, and what you want to do, though, is you get the heat up to maybe medium-high. You have a little fat in the pan. This is just the basic, okay? You know, like this is step one no matter what kind of seasoning you use. And you take that fillet, make sure it's dry. If you wanted to, you could have dipped it in a little bit of flour, you know, that has salt and pepper in it if you wanted to. But you can do it either way. And have a generous amount of oil in that pan, even though it's nonstick, just because it'll be easier to loosen the fish. You put it in the pan and you let it cook for maybe a minute. And then take a spatula and just slip it under the fish and gently turn it over and cook it maybe another minute, and then knock the heat down really low. And the way you know it's done is when you make a little cut, it's white to the center. It no longer looks raw. Okay? And try not to overdo it. You know, better to take it out of the pan a little before it's done than after, because it'll continue cooking from the heat. Now, as far as seasoning goes, you could do olive oil in that pan. You could throw in a few black olives into the pan, all right? And then you could sprinkle the fish with some salt and pepper and thin sliced garlic. And it can be just delicious. And if you wanted to, in that pan could also be just one or two chopped up cherry tomatoes, you know, or grape tomatoes. And so you have a big pan, you have a couple of pieces of that fish, and this little bits and pieces of things sauteing with the fish. Cook the fish the way I said, put it on the plate, and then add a little more tomato to the pan and boil all that down with a little white wine. It'll take you 3 minutes at most. And now you got a pan sauce. Pour that over the fish, and it's utterly delicious.
Sounds really good.
It's really easy. And then you could do that same idea, but switch the ingredients. Put a little hot chopped fresh chilies in there, mm-hmm. the garlic, put some chopped onion in the pan as you're cooking the fish, and maybe even a few chunks of fresh fruit, you know, like mango or pineapple. But you don't want a lot. You don't want to crowd the pan and stew the fish. You want to be sauteing those things with the fish. And then when you put it down on the plate, my mouth is watering, excuse me, sprinkle fresh lime over it. And and now you have sort of a coastal Mexican feel to the whole thing. So give those a shot.
Thank you. I appreciate your help. I'm definitely going to try it out this weekend.
Enjoy. Take care.
Bye.
You know, fish is really that easy. You sear it on both sides and then you cook it really low. And if it's super thin,
you know, figure it's going to take probably 2 minutes, maybe three. And it continues cooking when it comes out of the pan. So better to undercook than overcook. Okay? Call us, 800-537-5252. We've got Ilana on the line, and she's calling from Huntington Woods, Michigan. Ilana, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about shish tawuk and how all these great Arabic restaurants in Detroit can make really moist chicken kebabs and deboned chicken, and I can't.
All right. Now, wait. Let's start at the beginning. What kind of dishes are we talking about?
The Arabic chicken dishes. When we go to the restaurants here, they'll have what they call it shish tawuk. It's the chicken on the skewers, and it's lemony and incredibly moist and spicy.
Right.
And the other thing that they do is just a deboned chicken, which is pretty much the same kind of flavorings, but just the flat chicken.
Right.
But it's always so moist, and I'm always so nervous about, you know, not cooking the chicken enough. And so I've, you know, marinated in lemon and tried all these spices, and I can only make dry skewers.
Now, let me ask you, the skewer chicken that they're using, are they using breast or are they using thigh?
I think it's white meat. I think
okay.
it's breast.
Because if it's white meat, it dries up really easily.
It doesn't look like dark meat.
I will bet you dollars to donuts that it is brined.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And this is one of the ways that you build in an insurance policy of having moist white meat chicken. So what you might do is you take, I gather you're starting what, with a boneless, skinless chicken breast?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What you do is you take maybe a third of a cup of salt, like kosher salt, coarse
uh-huh.
salt, okay, not iodized salt. You take a couple of tablespoons of sugar, all right? I would take the zest of half of a large lemon, and I would add to that, I would put this in a bowl where you can fit your chicken breasts very easily,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I would probably throw about 4 or 5 cloves of garlic in there, because I'm imagining this is pretty garlicky too.
Can't go wrong with
garlic. Right. Okay, crush those, put them in, and then put in very cold water. You need about a quart of really cold water, 3 to 4 cups. You stir that around until everything's blended, and then you slip in your chicken breasts and put them in the refrigerator and give them about 3 hours, 4 hours. Take them out and then put them in the marinade. Tell me what your marinade is.
Usually lemon juice, and I put some olive oil, and then like za'atar spices.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the za'atar spices, which is that mixture that is...
Sumac and...
Yeah, and the sumac else. Has that super lemony flavor, too. I would be generous with the olive oil, because that'll help protect them from drying out, because, you know, when you use
like
an acid...
how much would you use?
Let's say you had 4 large chicken breasts that you'd cut in. You cut them into chunks before you marinate them, right?
Yes.
Okay. If I had 4 large chicken breasts, I'd probably use a half a cup of olive oil, and then I would use about a half a cup or less, a third of a cup of fresh squeezed lemon juice. And then I would do, you've already got the garlic sort of in there. With the brining, I would do a generous amount of the spices, so a tablespoon maybe of the za'atar. And you don't need salt. You could use black pepper. And give that marinade another, you know, I mean, if you wanted to, you could leave it overnight. But the key here is too much acid will toughen your meat.
Oh, maybe I've been using too much lemon juice.
Yeah, maybe you have. And also maybe have you been cooking them very, very hot?
You know?
Okay, cook them a little slower. You know, if you're doing them over a grill, let the ash get really gray and then cook them slow. And brush them with a little olive oil and a little bit of sumac.
Huh.
You know, which is that reddish, wonderful spice.
Oh, yeah.
That's it's really lemony. It's so good. And in fact, one of the tricks I do is you don't cook the sumac. You put the sumac on just before you serve it because it gives that punch. See if that does it. But the brining is always the safety thing because all that moisture gets absorbed into the chicken and it defends it against getting dry.
Yeah, well, that's a great idea. I never would have thought of the brining.
Yeah. Whenever you're brining, though, remember, if you want to brine and flavor at the same time, really overdo the flavorings. Otherwise, you get nothing.
And you're pouring it all out.
Well, yeah. And you know, I see these brine recipes where, you know, you have a gallon of water and, God knows how much salt and whatever. And then they have 2 cloves of garlic and 3 sprigs of thyme. Well, you know, better to put the garlic behind your ears than to do it. So, you know, if you want a flavor with your brine, then really overdo it with the flavorings. Hey, enjoy.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
I did have a fish thing. I have to tell you, with the tilapia,
yeah,
what I'd love to do is you put pesto on the fish and you sort of bread it with crushed pistachio nuts.
Holy cow.
And you bake it.
Ooh.
And it is amazing.
That's
so. I want to give you back something.
Hey, thank you, ma'am.
Thanks again.
Take care, Ilana. Enjoy.
To do good things.
Thank you. Thank you. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We've got an email from Claire in Seattle, and it's about making gelato versus ice cream. She says, I enjoy the delicious gelato from our favorite local vendor, but when it comes to making it myself, I've drawn a complete blank. I can't find recipes for homemade gelato. Now, I've heard rumors I need a specific machine to make it. What is gelato really, and how does it differ from ice cream, and can I make it at home? The answer is you can make it at home. You don't need a special machine, but an ice cream maker helps. But here is the key. Gelato is made from milk, not cream. It's a lower fat frozen dessert than ice cream is. Okay. And it is made in a couple of ways. It is either the milk and a puree or a juice of fresh fruit, usually a puree. The flavors are more intense. All right. And a sugar syrup. Or it is a custard base where the milk is cooked with egg yolks and sugar and then put in an ice cream maker and churned. But the other thing that makes gelato gelato is that it is always served soft. So when you put it in the ice cream freezer, the tricky thing is that you want it to become just below freezing. When you stick an instant reading thermometer in it, it should read maybe 30 degrees, maybe 25 degrees, but you never want it frozen solid. You want it creamy. You've had it. You know the consistency you're going for. So the idea would be that you make whatever ice cream recipe you have, but you use milk. Now, one of the basics here would be, for instance, 2 cups of milk, something like a half a cup or so of sugar, and about 5 large egg yolks. And that would be the beginning. And you would cook that to 170 degrees, stirring constantly, chill it way down, add whatever flavoring you want. It could be vanilla, it could be whatever, and you're off and running. Or you can do the pureed fruit with a sugar syrup. So, but there are recipes out there. There are, and there's been a couple of books about gelato as well. But just remember, it is milk-based, but you never want it frozen solid. And that's the real key to gelato. Anyone who serves solid frozen gelato doesn't have a clue of what they're doing. Call us, 800-537-5252. And Claire, thanks for writing. Some of us are easily amused. I mean, you give me a few idioms with fun stories attached, and I am a happy camper. Now, just in case English 101 is a dim memory, an idiom is a phrase whose meaning cannot be determined by its words. You have to know the culture that it comes from. Writer Jag Bala is an idiomologist, and he's author of I'm Not Hanging Noodles on Your Ears and Other Intriguing Idioms from Around the World. Jag, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. It's my great pleasure to be here.
Okay, I have to know the title. What does this mean, I'm not hanging noodles on your ears?
I'm not hanging noodles on your ears is the Russian equivalent of I'm not pulling your leg. And as you can guess, I mean, there are a lot of cultures that want to express that same sentiment, and some of them do it actually with food-related expressions. The Spanish, when they say they are pulling your leg, they say they're giving it to you with cheese.
Oh.
One of my favorite ones in that area is from Japan, and Japan has some ones that sound wonderfully exotic to us. When they say that they're not pulling your leg, they say they're not pulling the hairs from your nostrils.
Oh, what a charming thought.
But the Japanese, actually, one of the joys of looking at languages is how language expresses what's most important in different cultures, and obviously that applies in food culture also. And for the Japanese, tea and rice are obviously very important, and they have an expression which is kind of related to pulling your leg or hanging noodles, which means that don't make me laugh, as in that's unbelievable. What you said is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And they say that by saying, that's enough to make me want to make tea with my navel.
You know, there's another expression. You've got navel figures into this quite often, this part of the anatomy, I think, into this book. Onions should grow inside your navel. What does that mean, and where does it come from?
That's Yiddish, and it's kind of a minor insult. Another similar insult from Yiddish is, his head should grow in the ground like an onion. And actually, my all-time favorite Yiddish insult is, it's a little bit stronger than, it's more like a curse than a mild insult. It's, may all your teeth except one fall out, and may that have toothache.
Oh, boy. An idiom is pretty revealing about how a people see themselves, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you saw, you know, an example of how the Japanese are kind of very precise about things. It's not enough to pull your hair or anything. They have to pull the hair out of your nostrils.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite German ones is their equivalent of to live in luxury or to live the life of Riley is to live like a maggot in bacon.
Well, Jack, I wish I had on the tip of my tongue a response to that. That was an idiom, but I don't. So I'm just going to say thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. It's my great pleasure.
Jack Bala is author of I'm Not Hanging Noodles on Your Ears and Other Intriguing Idioms from Around the World. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and we're looking forward to meeting up with you next week. But until then, let me leave you with this poem from Josip Busin. In my garden, I pick a muskmelon, feeling like a thief. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Roseanne Perea. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Now, we're going to be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.